So who else is with us tonight so far?
Marcia Zimmerman's here.
Hi, Marcia.
Hi, Lisa.
Richard Ayers.
Maureen Shore.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, Richard Ayers calling.
Hi, Richard. It's Alicia from San Diego.
Hello. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you.
Virginia DeMore here.
Hi, Virginia. Did you have problems getting on?
No. I was trying to get on the Internet, and I couldn't do that.
No, we haven't figured that one out yet.
Okay.
I'm Stephanie Singer in California.
Yes, I am.
Lucy from Michigan.
Yeah, Richard Ayers from Michigan.
Maureen Shore from Lockport, New York.
Tiffany House from San Antonio, Texas.
Hi, Tiffany.
Hey.
Have you heard from your mom?
Yeah, but they're on their way up to A&M, so she's not going to make it.
Okay, well, I hope they have a safe trip.
Yeah, she called about an hour ago, and they were still on their way.
How do you call? Hi, it's Joe Boyer from Pennsylvania.
John Cole from Eddie.
Great.
Sharon Krieger from Oregon.
Hi, Sharon. It's Alicia.
Hi, Alicia.
How you doing, sweetie?
Good.
Good, good, good.
Robert Austin from North Carolina.
Sounds like we have a good group tonight, everybody.
It does.
Like it.
I can't wait to hear what Dr. Bach has to say.
Oh, you and me both, Marcia.
I'm interested.
Oh, I know. This could be a neat thing.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to him a little bit before, and I thought, oh, wow, we've got to have him on for a conference.
Well, thank
you, Marcia. Do all of you work with people with Pompe's disease?
I have it.
Okay.
I have it.
So do I.
I have it.
Me too.
We all do. Yeah.
You all do.
Is anyone on the ventilator besides me?
My daughter Maureen is. I'm speaking for my daughter. She's on the ventilator.
I take care of a gentleman who's been trached in on a ventilator for 5 years.
Jeez.
I've been on BiPAP at night for 13 years.
Yeah, I'm on a ventilator with a mask, just night only, for 8 years.
Yeah.
Wow. And I'm on a tracheal vent at night for 13 years.
What's the name of that one? Mm.
Pardon me?
I didn't hear what you said you were on.
I got a trach and a ventilator, and I'm on at night.
I'm on a BiPAP at night.
That's what I've been trying to do, and I can't do it.
Oh.
That's what I was wondering about.
It took me probably 4 weeks to get used to it before I could sleep through the night.
It took me 5 minutes.
Yeah, you got that right.
And then I was asleep for 15 hours, and my husband kept thinking I was dead.
Yeah, my blood gases were so high that when I got on it, it was a godsend.
Yeah, same here. There's nothing like sleep deprivation and waking up gasping for breath in the middle of the night and then having, excuse the expression, brain farts during the day.
Yeah.
Where you just all of a sudden you can't think straight and add two and two and you get seven.
Boy, you guys, none of that is necessary. That shouldn't be happening, you know?
Well, that
was prior to being placed on a BiPAP.
Yeah, okay. What settings are you using on BiPAP?
14 and 4. Ever since I've been on the BiPAP, I'm fine.
Yeah, 14 and 4 is much better.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes it's used at lower IPAPs, and that's a mistake. And frankly, higher IPAPs would be even better for you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
So far, so good.
Mm-hmm. No, but see, the higher the IPAP, it gives you more rest overnight, so you feel less fatigued and you should feel stronger during the day.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. But with the higher IPAP, you should be even better.
Oh, thank you.
The IPAP going as far as how high?
Well, depending on how stiff the lungs are, but see, for normal lungs, you need to go to 18 anyway.
Oh.
18 to 20.
Okay.
Because that's what it would take to rest any person's muscles when they sleep.
Okay.
18 to 20.
Okay.
Anyhow, you know, my name is John Bach.
Hi, Dr. Bach.
Yeah. I thought, how many people are on the conference?
I'm not real sure yet. I'm calling later on. Right now, it looks like maybe 20-ish.
Everybody count off.
Richard Ayers, Michigan.
Tracy, Michigan.
Marcia Zimmerman.
Brian White, Virginia. Orange Shore, New York.
Virginia DeMora.
Don Cole from Cincinnati.
Alicia from San Diego.
Aaron from Oregon.
Jared. California.
Jared from San Diego.
Carol White from Pocosin, Virginia.
Tiffany House from Texas.
Joe Bork, Pennsylvania.
Robert Austin, North Carolina.
Keith Armstrong, Virginia.
Oh, we got the East Coast and the West Coast. Nobody in the middle. What's the deal?
I know.
Well, shall we start?
Yes.
Yes.
You know what I'd like to do is I'd like to give you some background information, and then you can ask me questions, okay?
Okay.
Well, first, let me tell you, with this condition... What was that?
Before you get going, real quick, 5 minutes before the end of the hour, I'm going to break in and let you know, Dr. Bach, you have 5 minutes to wrap up so you can get out of here at 9:30. And for the people on, if you try not to monopolize the question-answer period and let everyone have a chance to ask a question, that would be great. And if you're planning on making a bunch of background noise, if you would mute your line by pushing star 6. And if you want to talk, push star 6 again, and that will get you where you can speak. All righty. I'm done.
Okay. Well, let me put this all in perspective. You know, this condition involves basically muscle weakness, as you know, and the only way that it can really severely harm anybody or kill anybody is because of the effect of muscle weakness, in particular the respiratory muscles. Now, sometimes the heart being a muscle can be involved, but is not nearly involved to any degree like the respiratory muscles in general. So most people really suffer from the involvement of the respiratory muscles. Now, what are the respiratory muscles? You have to think about three groups of muscles. One are the inspiratory muscles for breathing, the expiratory muscles for coughing, and those are, for example, mostly the abdominal muscles and some of the chest muscles. And then there's what we call the bulbar muscles or the throat muscles. The throat muscles are largely spared in Pompe's disease. I don't know of any patients who have lost the ability to speak, swallow, and then can't protect their airway such that they're basically drowned in saliva dripping in the airway. Now, this is very different from many other neuromuscular conditions. For example, in Lou Gehrig's disease, there's a type that is called bulbar ALS, in which patients can walk around and even play tennis, but they can't speak or swallow, and eventually they need to get a tracheostomy tube because they can't keep the saliva out of their airway. The good news in Pompe's disease is that I don't think that ever happens, and so nobody should ever need a tracheostomy tube or ever even develop respiratory complications if you are properly informed and equipped. Now, what does that mean? That means that there are people who get so weak that they really can't breathe effectively. If they can't take deep enough breaths, the carbon dioxide in the blood goes up. And that causes many of the symptoms that you were talking about before. Morning headaches, daytime drowsiness, difficulty concentrating, depression, loss of libido, problems with concentration. And fatigue is the most subtle and the most common symptom of not breathing deeply enough to maintain normal carbon dioxide. In fact, for a little comparison, it's sort of like walking into a vat of fermenting wine where the carbon dioxide is so high that it can actually turn off your breathing completely and you stop breathing.
Mm.
Now, what happens when you don't breathe deeply and the carbon dioxide goes up is that because carbon dioxide is acidic, the kidneys have to retain bicarbonate so that the blood doesn't become acidic, because if we can't permit the blood to become acidic. So the kidneys retain bicarbonate to neutralize the acid. What that does, though, is that turns off the brain's breathing apparatus so that the brain doesn't expect to breathe deeply anymore, and it's like a bad cycle. The carbon dioxide keeps getting higher and higher, the bicarbonate gets higher and higher, and then what happens one morning is you simply don't wake up. This happens to many people with all neuromuscular conditions. What happens even more commonly than that, though, especially for children, is that they get a cold and or bronchitis, or what we call RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, in little kids. And because their abdominal muscles can be very weak, and they may not be able to cough effectively, the sputum lies in the airway, and the bacteria multiply, they get pneumonia, and then they get short of breath, go to the local emergency room, and the doctor there gives them oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
That turns off their breathing even worse. The carbon dioxide goes even higher, and they stop breathing, and then they get a tube down their throats and get hooked up to a ventilator. So, the two ways that people can suffer and die from respiratory muscle weakness is because of inability to cough effectively, which is the most common problem, and resulting in intermittent pneumonias, and simply not breathing deeply. Now, after the age of 40, we get fewer colds, sometimes only one every 5 to 10 years, whereas kids get a couple colds a year. So usually for children with neuromuscular disease, they usually do okay till they get a bronchitis, and then they get the pneumonia and go into respiratory failure. Whereas for older people, they may just gradually develop higher and higher carbon dioxide retention until they become very symptomatic. And if they're not put on some sort of nighttime ventilatory assistance, they can literally not wake up in the morning, just be comatose and either be rushed to the hospital or even die that way. Now, as I said, the good news was that the throat muscles are rarely affected, if ever affected, to the extent that people need tracheostomy tubes with Pompe's disease. But people do get tracheostomy tubes anyway, because the doctors often think that inability to breathe or inability to cough or clear the airway is an indication for a tracheostomy tube. And this is what you have to understand, that, well, I have many patients who have had no ability to breathe. They've had zero vital capacity for over 50 years.
Mm.
Now, if you don't know what a vital capacity is, I'm going to tell you very briefly. It's when you take as deep a breath as you can and you blow it into a spirometer that just measures the volume of air that you're able to put into your lungs in one deep breath. That's called the vital capacity. And most of you have probably had vital capacities measured. For a normal breath, we generally need about 500 or 600 milliliters of air. If the vital capacity is 600 or 700 milliliters, then we can breathe without ventilators okay, although breathing at, if each breath is about 80% of our capacity, it does tend to, if we did that all the time, it could tire our diaphragms out. And so that's when the brain starts to allow us to breathe more shallowly and the carbon dioxide go up sometimes. So many people whose vital capacities are 600 or 700, especially as we get older, they may very well be retaining some carbon dioxide or a little bit more than normal. Let's see. I'm trying to think of what I was going to tell you about this particular point. But, oh, yes. When you cough, however, most people don't realize it, but an average cough is four times the vital capacity.
Mm.
So if someone's vital capacity is, say, 1,000, they may have a normal carbon dioxide and be able to breathe perfectly well.
Mm-hmm.
But if they get a flu, the first part of a cough is a deep breath, about 2.5 liters. And everybody takes a deep breath when they cough. If you try to cough with your lungs empty, you'll see that the cough is not as effective. So part of the reason that the cough becomes less effective is because people can't take a deep breath. So what needs to be done simply, well, as I was mentioning, my patients who for over 50 years, I've had patients over 50 years with zero vital capacity. Zero vital capacity. Now that means that they cannot breathe a single breath or even 10% of a normal breath. They can't breathe anything, okay, for over 50 years. And yet none of them have tracheostomy tubes. They have a little mouthpiece by their mouths that's hooked up to a ventilator on the back of a wheelchair or at the bedside, and they get deep breaths through the mouthpiece. The mouthpiece is 15 millimeters. It's not in the mouth. It's next to the mouth, so they just grab it a couple times a minute to get deep breaths. Some people with a little bit of vital capacity They can breathe on their own, but their voice is very low because they don't breathe to a deep volume to be able to speak loudly. And in, when there's a lot of ambient noise, it's impossible to hear them. So we often will get a ventilator like that with the mouthpiece next to the mouth, and then they can grab it and get a deep breath when they are when they need to raise their voice or when they need to cough. Now, one of the things we teach our patients is what we call air stacking. Air stacking is when the machine delivers a breath and you hold it with your throat. And then you let it cycle another breath and get it double that volume and then triple the volume and keep going till you fill your lungs with air. Now, this is extremely important because probably most of you understand what range of motion is, because most of you, or many of you, have probably seen physical therapists, and they've taught you that if you don't stretch your ankles, they get stiff. If you don't stretch different joints that have some weak muscles, they get stiff. Well, the same is true of the lungs and the chest wall. If you don't fill your lungs completely to what to their predicted inspiratory capacity, then parts of the lung close down and the chest wall gets stiff. And if this problem becomes severe and you can't get a real deep breath to cough effectively with, then, you know, like I tell my therapist, have you ever seen anybody die from a stiff ankle? Well, no, but you can die from a stiff lung. Mm-hmm. Yet the therapists aren't teaching people how to mobilize their lungs and their chest walls. So the first goal for anybody is, number one, find out what your vital capacity is. And we look at it in two ways. The absolute value, which could be 1,000 milliliters or 500 milliliters, and also the percent of what it should be. If the percent of what it should be is less than 70 or 80%, then everybody should be doing range of motion for the lungs and rib cage. And to do that is very simple. All you have to do is get what we call an AMBU bag or a manual resuscitator. That's one of those balloon things with a mouthpiece on the end. And we put it, you put it in the mouth and you squeeze it and basically inflate the lungs, just like you would a balloon. You take a deep breath, hold it with the throat, and then take another one on top of that. We call that air stacking. And you air stack up to as much air as you can hold, and that stretches out the lungs and the chest wall and keeps them healthy and elastic. Now, as the vital capacity goes down further, the most important thing is not the vital capacity when you're sitting. It's the vital capacity when you lie down. Because in Pompe's disease, there's a tendency for the diaphragm to be involved a little more than the chest muscles sometimes. And that causes the vital capacity to be lower when you're lying down than when you're sitting. In fact, the symptoms from that are that people can often breathe okay when they're sitting, but they can't breathe lying flat. And that's very common. And that's because of a little bit of excessive involvement of the diaphragm. And that's a very easy thing to take care of. Some of you are using BiPAP, and that's okay. However, if the vital capacities are under 70% or so, I don't recommend BiPAP. Now, for those of you who don't know what BiPAP is, let me tell you just a couple words about that. In the 1970s, we discovered a disease that Dickens had described 150 years ago in Pickwick syndrome, you know. That's when people have obstructive apneas when they sleep, and they may be very much overweight and not strong enough to move their lungs, for their diaphragm to ventilate their lungs. Well, they developed something called CPAP at that time. CPAP stands for Continuous Positive Airway Pressure. This is the same as breathing with your head out of the window of a car going about 50 miles an hour. It should never be used for anybody with neuromuscular disease because it doesn't help anybody breathe. It's true that it helps if you have obstructive sleep apneas, but it doesn't directly rest the muscles or assist the muscles. And for those 500-pound people who are still not strong enough to ventilate their lungs, the Respironics, they would try CPAP at 15 centimeters of water. Now, that's like exhaling in a tornado. You know, it's like exhaling against a tremendous flow of air that makes it difficult to actually get the air out. It's uncomfortable, and it doesn't do any good. So Respironics developed a BiPAP machine, and BiPAP stands for Bi-Level Positive Airway Pressure. And what that does is it's a box that pushes out a constant stream of air like CPAP, except that you can adjust the pressure separately from when you're inhaling and when you're exhaling. So if somebody gives you air under positive pressure to your nose and mouth, to your lungs, while you're inhaling, it makes it easier to inhale. If they give you positive pressure when you're trying to exhale, that makes it more difficult to exhale. So you can lower that pressure. So, for example, you can give an inspiratory pressure of, say, 10 and an expiratory pressure of 4, and then you're actually giving a pressure assist of 6, 10 minus 4, or 6. Now, if I get hit by a truck and become a C2 quadriplegic and I have a zero vital capacity, you're not going to ventilate me or anybody else with a pressure of 6. I would die quickly at that rate, okay? You need a pressure of 18 to 20 centimeters of water for normally compliant lungs. So what typically happens to people is that their doctors send them for a sleep study, and that shows that there's some problem with breathing during sleep, and they're put on BiPAP. But they're put on BiPAP at a low span, something like an inspiratory pressure of 10, an expiratory pressure of 5. That gives them help. That helps them a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But as they get weaker, their carbon dioxides go up anyway, and eventually they sort of collapse, and then they're told they need a trach tube, which is absolutely wrong. Once they do get a trach tube, though, and they're hooked up to a different type of ventilator, if you look at the gauge on the ventilator, it always reads pressures of 20 or 30. Well, obviously, if you gave the pressure of 20 or 30 non-invasively through the nose, like with a BiPAP machine, the patient wouldn't have collapsed in the first place and had to be intubated and get a trach tube. But most doctors don't think of that. They really don't. It's incredible how people go from BiPAP and then they develop a cold and can't cough, get pneumonia, develop respiratory failure, then they're told that they need to be trached. Well, anyway, so what is the solution for this? Basically, patients who are sent to pulmonary functions laboratories are basically wasting their time and their money. The laboratories are designed for people with lung disease and airways disease. Now, the same thing is true for arterial blood gases. You guys never need arterial blood gases. What should be done, and what we do is, we have a little machine called a capnograph that monitors, that measures the carbon dioxide level at the air that you exhale from the nose. So we know the carbon dioxide, the oximeter tells us the oxygen saturation. And a spirometer is needed to measure the vital capacity, but not just when you're sitting, but also when you're lying down, because when that difference is 7% or less, that's normal. But often when you lie down, the vital capacity is half of what it is when you're sitting. And even if when you're sitting it's 3,000, I can guarantee you pretty much that if the vital capacity is less than half that when you lie down, you can't breathe. Which means that you can go to a laboratory, they'll find that you have a practically normal vital capacity, but you can't breathe lying down anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So the treatment is to use a ventilator to give nasal ventilation overnight, or even lip seal ventilation, because the air can be delivered through the nose or it could be delivered through the mouth also. Actually, lip seal ventilation works better than nasal ventilation, but again, doctors aren't familiar with it. Nasal ventilation, the air can go through the nose and leak out of the mouth. Whereas with the lip seal, it can't leak out of the mouth, and the air doesn't usually go back up and leak out of the nose. So anybody having difficulty with nasal ventilation, if they're still symptomatic, there's two things to think about. Number one, the settings are no good. They're much too low. So if anyone's using nasal ventilation with BiPAP and still feels symptomatic, maybe better, but not completely better, and maybe still some tiredness and so on, number one, the settings are probably too low. You should be on a span of well over 10. So, for example, if the EPAP on your machine doesn't go below 4, and many of the new machines it doesn't, like the Synchrony, for example, it only goes down to 4, then you have to be on an EPAP of 15 or more, even to get a span of 10 or 11. So, number one, you got to increase that span. Make that, if you can, something like 20 EPAP and an EPAP of 2, if you can. If the EPAP will go down that low. The old BiPAP STs, it does go down to 2. The second problem that you have to suspect is excessive leak out of the mouth. Now, normally that only happens if people are taking sedatives, narcotics, or oxygen. None of you should be taking oxygen. Oxygen is like putting a Band-Aid on a cancer. The cancer is under ventilation and airway secretions. If you don't correct the ventilation and don't remove secretions when you have them, the thing gets worse, you get worse, and you end up going into respiratory failure. And oxygen turns off the brain's ventilatory drive. It turns off your breathing. So it gradually allows the carbon dioxide to get higher and higher. So I'll tell you right now, none of you should be taking oxygen. If you're taking it, it's probably as a substitute for good ventilation. Now, let's talk a little bit about these BiPAP machines, these machines. BiPAP is a pressure-cycled ventilator. In other words, you adjust the pressure, and it delivers air till it feels that pressure, and then it shuts off. So, for example, if you adjust it to 20, it'll deliver a volume of air until it feels that pressure of 20, and then if you hold that air and try to air stack with it, you can't do it. Because as soon as it delivers another volume of air, it's going to sense the 20 immediately and not give any air, okay? So you cannot air stack with BiPAP, which is why I never prescribe it for anybody over the age of 5, with the exception of the bulbar ALS patients who can't air stack anyway because their throat is too weak. The other type of ventilator, which is more appropriate for all of you, really, is a volume cycle ventilator, where you simply adjust the volume instead of the pressure, and the machine doesn't really care what the pressure is. It's going to deliver the volume that you set it at. The main reason why this is more appropriate is because you can air stack and get deeper breaths and cough better and speak louder and all of that. But also, volume cycle ventilators are more quiet. They have more alarms, which is not a benefit. You have to turn them off, actually, most of the time. But it is more expensive than BiPAP, which is why everybody likes to use BiPAP, you know, because it's simply less expensive. But it's also much more comfortable, volume ventilators, because you don't have to give EPAP. There isn't any EPAP. So it's more comfortable, they're quieter, you can air stack with them, they're very reliable, but they're more expensive than BiPAP. Okay, so now, let's see. For ventilation, anyone needing who cannot breathe lying flat should be using nasal ventilation or lip seal ventilation from a volume cycle ventilator, ideally. And if the carbon dioxide tends to go up during the daytime, usually people are not symptomatic, provided that they're using something at night, like some of you are, and that the daytime oxygen saturation is normal. And normal is 95 or more. Remember this, and this is very important. The oxygen saturation can only go down below 95 for three reasons when you're awake. One is, if the carbon dioxide goes up high, the oxygen goes down. And for that, that's prevented by getting deep breaths through a mouthpiece, using a ventilator. The second reason is mucus in the airway, which blocks the lung's respiratory exchange membrane. That causes the oxygen to go down without the carbon dioxide going up. The treatment for that is assisted coughing. Both the deep insufflation, the deep, deep breath of air stacking, pressing on the belly to help the abdominal muscles. And if that's not adequate, then there's a machine, which is sort of like a vacuum cleaner, called the cough assist. That machine gives a real deep breath, and then the pressure drops from plus 40 to minus 40, typically. That causes an effective cough. It clears the airway, brings the secretions out, and patients don't develop pneumonia. The third reason for the oxygen to go below 95 is if you don't use the second one correctly, and then you end up with pneumonia or atelectasis. And actually, this is inevitable for everybody, because we peak in terms of our strength at the age of 19, and after that we all lose 1% or more of liver function, kidney function, heart function, respiratory function, everything, you name it. The most common cause, or over 30% of people, otherwise healthy people in nursing homes, die from pneumonia because they're just not coughing effectively anymore. So it's really just a matter of time for everybody. And if you start off with some sort of condition that makes your muscles weaker to begin with, then you end up in trouble sooner. And But, you know, that's the bad news. But the good news is that the trouble is preventable just by learning how to do effective manually assisted coughing, and ultimately, if that's not adequate, to get at least, well, we, you know, 300 liters per second of cough flow, 300 liters per minute of second of cough flow, then the cough assist is available. So when patients come to us, we really measure four things, as I started to say before. The carbon dioxide level, painlessly, the oxygen saturation, the vital capacity, sitting and lying down, and also the air stacking capability, which is, you know, again, how high beyond the vital capacity you can go, which is the most important indicator of all. And fourthly, the cough flows. And not only the spontaneous cough flows, but also the assisted cough flows. Because if the unassisted cough flow goes below 300 liters a minute, then there's a significant risk of developing pneumonia when you have bronchitis. So then we teach assisted coughing, which is, again, getting those deep, deep breaths by air stacking and pressing on the belly to increase the cough flows. And if they are not adequate, then we teach patients how to use the cough assist, and that will do the job. Anybody who can speak or swallow, even if you can't swallow, as long as people can speak, their throat muscles are adequate such that even if you can't breathe at all and can't cough at all, there's no need to even think about a tracheostomy tube or to die from respiratory complications. Many of you have heard of Duchenne muscular dystrophy. These are people who are supposed to die when they're 18 to 20 years old. When they get trach tubes, they survive an extra average of 7 years, but then they die from complications of the trach tube. Our patients survive into their 30s and 40s without trach tubes, and we haven't had to put a trach tube in one in over 25 years, and literally nobody's dying from respiratory complications with Duchenne because of the cough assist and because of non-invasive ventilation. And there's one other disease I'm going to tell you about, which is astounds even me, because up until 10 years ago, I thought that children with Wernicke-Hoffmann's disease would die without trach tubes because they're born paralyzed, 90% are dead by 12 months of age, and 100% by the second birthday, and they can't speak, can't swallow, and I had parents of two of the kids refuse trach tubes, and their kids are still alive today, 10 years later. So as a result of what we learned from them, we're not putting trach tubes in other babies with Wernicke-Hoffmann's disease either, and most of them are surviving. And it's all because of non-invasive ventilation, sometimes as much as 24 hours a day, and the cough assist machine to help people cough effectively. Let me see. That's, I think, the basic information that you need to know. Oh, there's another thing. Sometimes you're okay, and then you have to have some sort of surgery, appendicitis or gastrostomy tube or God knows what. Anything done under local anesthesia should not be any problem. But if you're given general anesthesia, that causes airway secretions, which can be post-op. There's tiredness, weakness, difficulty coughing, and people can get pneumonia, atelectasis and pneumonia. It's extremely important for anybody with a cough flow under 300 liters a minute to see that a family member, or, you know, even if the hospital has cough assist machines, which most of them don't, no nurse or therapist has the time to use it every 5 minutes all day long. And if you have, you know, doctors have a tendency to write orders like give the treatment every 4 hours or every 2 hours. Well, when you have bronchitis, can you wait 4 hours to cough? Mm-hmm. Of course not. You have to cough sometimes all the time, every 5 minutes, every 2 minutes. Well, if you don't get help coughing when you need it, then that's when you get pneumonia. So I always tell patients, doctors, to write an order on the chart that the family can help the patient with the cough assist, ad lib, to use it as needed. And we use the oximeter as feedback. So, as I mentioned before, a normal oxygen saturation is 95 or more. Nobody can ever develop respiratory failure with normal oxygen saturation unless you give them oxygen. Again, mm-hmm. Nobody should be getting oxygen. Even in the hospital, that should be used as a last resort, but certainly nobody at home should ever be given oxygen. We have the families watch the patient, and if the oxygen saturation goes below 95, to use the cough assist immediately until the saturation goes back to 95 or more. And that's how come the patients don't get pneumonia and stay in the hospital after any kind of operation. Now, people who get gastrostomy tubes, in our place and in a few other places in the country, they can get them under local anesthesia. Actually, for adults, many places do that. For children, there's only a couple places in the country that can put in gastrostomy tubes under local anesthesia. But actually, in my last book, I actually described all the surgery with the pictures, and I tell people to, you know, get copies, copy out this stuff for their doctors. And if their doctors can't do it this way, they should come to us or to Massachusetts, where it can be done without risk under local anesthesia. But we actually have patients come to us from all over the country for scoliosis surgery because I guarantee that they will not need to have trach tubes. And I can guarantee that because of the following. We have patients come before the surgery, and we teach them non-invasive ventilation, like BiPAP at night with the nose piece, mouthpiece ventilation, and we teach them how to do assisted coughing and use the cough assist. And once a patient knows how to use BiPAP through the nose or through the mouth, then I know that after the surgery, even if they are so weak that they cannot breathe at all, that once their lungs are healthy, we can take the tube out without putting in a tracheostomy tube and ventilate them on non-invasive ventilation, even 24 hours a day if necessary, until they get stronger again and can wean back to using nighttime ventilation only. Now, most other places, when a patient is intubated after surgery and they're too weak to breathe, they think they need to trach them. And we know that we don't need to trach patients because they can't breathe or they can't cough. So this is information also to keep in the back of your minds, because once doctors start talking about trach tubes, if I were you, I would say, I want out of here. You know, send me to New Jersey or someplace where they can extubate me without a trach tube. So if you teach someone how to use non-invasive ventilation and assisted coughing pre-op, even if they're so weak they can't breathe or cough post-op, you don't have to trach them. Okay, how about some questions? Anybody have any questions?
Richard Ayers in Michigan. A couple things. Can you explain to me what dead space means? That a trach evidently eliminates dead space.
Right. A trach reduces the amount of air that you have to breathe to ventilate your lungs. Because, see, the trach is lower than the mouth. So the air that goes between the mouth and the trach, every time you take a breath, let's say you take 600 milliliters of air, well, 40 milliliters is the amount of air that's between the trach and the mouth. So that's wasted effort, that extra 40 milliliters. Whereas if you're breathing through the trach, you're bypassing that 40 milliliters. That's no reason to get a trach tube.
I'm on a ventilator at night only.
Well, through a trach tube?
No, ventilator, nasal.
Good.
Night only, and I can still walk, sometimes assisted. And I can breathe okay, even though I short breathe a lot in the daytime.
Do you know what your carbon dioxide is during the day?
Really don't know.
Yeah.
I think I might make an appointment to come see you.
Yeah.
The guy I've got, I've had a lot of faith in, but he's big on blood gases.
Well, no, see, let me tell you the problem with blood gases. 30% of the time, people hyperventilate because of the pain, so the carbon dioxide is artificially low. This was published in one of the two big pulmonary journals in the country, but doctors are still doing blood gases because they've got into that habit and they don't have carbon dioxide monitors, even though they've been available for the last 20 years. The other reason that doctors do blood gases like that is because they're used to treating people with lung disease, and when you have lung disease, the capnograph is not as accurate. So they don't even think about using a capnograph because they don't have one, and, you know, they just stick people for blood gases. It's really not nearly as good to do blood gases because the blood gas CO2 is not only artificially low sometimes, but it's a one-point thing. See, whereas if you monitor the carbon dioxide, you can monitor it all night. We monitor it all night, in fact, sometimes, and it's painless.
One of the problems I have is I can't breathe when I'm laying flat at all.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The fear is that if I fall down in the daytime or something, I'll simply die because I can't breathe.
Well, you obviously have pretty good bulbar muscles, like most people with Pompe's disease. So one of the things that you could learn is glossopharyngeal breathing. And you could ventilate your lungs by using your throat, even if you were lying down.
Without a ventilator?
Yeah. Yeah. 2 out of 3 people can learn glossopharyngeal breathing sufficiently so that they don't even need to use a ventilator during the day.
How do I go about doing that?
Well, basically breathing like a frog. You know, frogs do not have diaphragms. They actually capture the air with their throats and they bring it into their lungs. And they'll take 3 or 4 gulps per breath, and that's basically what people do. Some people learn this on their own, you know. Other people, 2 out of 3 people learn it immediately when they see me do it. They just imitate me and they learn it that way. There are videotapes on glossopharyngeal breathing. Again, I gave references to a number of the videotapes in my book and some of my articles.
Your last 2 books, so I'll get that info.
Oh, you'll get the info. Yeah, I don't necessarily recommend that you get these videotapes because most people can learn it just through imitation. I describe in the book how you do it, but it's not by description that people learn. It's just by looking at someone who's doing it, you know, and you just imitate it, and people pick it up very quickly usually.
When I stand and face a mirror, you can obviously see that my neck muscles are used in breathing now.
Yeah, but see, your neck muscles get you tired. Those are called accessory muscles of breathing. If you're using accessory muscles of breathing during the daytime, that is tiring you out. And I would recommend that when you're sitting down, that you use a volume cycle ventilator with a little mouthpiece that you can just grab and get deep breaths, because that will rest your muscles and make you feel more energetic, less tired, and it'll completely relieve your accessory muscles there. People
What's the
using,
name of that?
Name of what?
This machine, because they put me on oxygen. I'm on oxygen.
Nobody should be on oxygen. You should be using a volume cycle ventilator. Now, there are many of them. There's a PLV from Respironix, the PLV-100, for example. There's an LP series, LP-10, 20, LP-6, the Achieva. They're all made by another company called Puritan Bennett, and those companies have been bought by other companies. I mean, there are so many. Basically, they're just the LP series. Any respiratory therapist knows these machines. There's the Newport volume ventilator. There's the LTV 800, 850, 900, 950.
Dr. Bach, you said they're a little more expensive than the BiPAPs?
Yes, volume ventilators are more expensive than BiPAPs, yeah.
Dr. Bach?
Yeah.
You're giving us a lot of information. I'm breaking up. Hold on. You're giving us a lot of information here. I'm wondering, will some of this be either recorded or maybe put in a short letter we can give to our doctors?
They are recording so I can use the transcript.
Well, we'll give some information about this. Some of you have seen one of my websites. Well, let me just tell you that the one website I would recommend you look at is called drbach.com. That's drbach.com. Now, on that website, the webmaster has put the template for the typical letter of medical necessity that I use for all of this equipment. All of you should have an oximeter, because if you get sick, then you put the oximeter on and you don't let the oxygen go below 95.
Right.
You use your vent, you use your assisted coughing, but if you wait until you're sick and then call for an oximeter, your saturations could be 75% and you'll have pneumonia before you even get the oximeter. And this is what happened before I was prescribing oximeters for people. So it's very important for all of you with a weak cough to have an oximeter in the house. Not to use every day or even every month, but when you get a cold, you put it on the finger and you don't let it go below 95. Now, I explain all of that basically in my letters of medical necessity, and examples of them are on the website. So you can print them out, you can give them to your local doctors, and they can adapt them for you. The numbers that I put on there are the numbers I told you before, the carbon dioxide, the oxygen saturation, the vital capacity, the cough flows, and all of that. But even if they don't have those numbers, they can use the letter of medical necessity to, you know, try to get you this equipment. So, yeah.
Do you recommend or do you believe that sleep studies are helpful for someone who, a patient who's not yet on mechanical ventilation at night?
That's a very good question, and the answer to that is no. I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Those sleep studies, first of all, are about $3,500. You go to the hospital, you can't sleep anyway, and then the doctor will sometimes find an abnormality and say that you have some sort of like sleep-disordered breathing. Now, sometimes they make the terrible mistake of prescribing CPAP, which is never appropriate. Other times they prescribe BiPAP, but they usually prescribe it at low spans. And then the patients are using it and they're feeling better, but then they get a cold and they go into respiratory failure, they go to the emergency room, and then they end up getting a trach tube. Now, the sleep study is not the primary thing, or the nighttime BiPAP is not the primary thing people need to learn. They need to know what to do when they get sick. They need to know how to cough more effectively, and also to maintain normal ventilation, not only at night, but also during the day. So the reason why I don't feel that sleep studies like polysomnograms are useful is because they don't monitor carbon dioxide. And the carbon dioxide is the most important thing to look at when you're sleeping if you want to know how someone is breathing. And we don't treat people even if the polysomnogram is not normal. We treat people if they're symptomatic. Because when you become symptomatic, then you will want to use nighttime ventilation. If you're not symptomatic, but the polysomnogram is abnormal, you're not going to want to use it anyway. And why should you bother? There's no evidence that it's doing you any good if you're not symptomatic.
You don't think... Now, is it possible to have normal oxygen saturation at night and still have elevated CO2 levels?
Yes, you can during the day, too. You can have normal carbon oxygen saturation with an elevated CO2. But when that is the case, usually people are not symptomatic and they really don't need any treatment. Usually. When people are retaining carbon dioxide to the extent that their daytime oxygen saturation goes below 95, usually they're really symptomatic and they benefit from using nighttime ventilation as well as sometimes daytime ventilation.
Okay.
Let me just say one thing. I do some sleep studies when I have doubts about whether a patient is symptomatic or not. But what I do is just monitor the carbon dioxide and the oxygen saturation. The rest of it is not important.
Yeah, my doctor tested my end-tidal CO2.
Oh, good, good.
But unfortunately, he doesn't. I mean, it dipped, or actually, it went slightly up, but it was not significant, and he doesn't have a lot of data. Because it's not a test that he normally does.
Right. No.
So he doesn't know
if your carbon dioxide level is, say, 45 or 48 or something like that during the day, but your oxygen saturation is 97, and you're using nighttime ventilation anyway, you're fine. If you're not using nighttime ventilation and your carbon dioxide's up a little and your sat's up, well, that would indicate to me that if it's up during the day, it's going to be higher during sleep. So then the person may be somewhat symptomatic, and a trial of nighttime ventilation would be worthwhile.
Is it normal for it to go up slightly at night in normal people?
Yeah, of course. And likewise, the oxygen saturation goes down in normal people.
Okay.
It goes down
so
below
it's not always a reason for concern.
Right.
The CO2 did go up, but it was not significant.
During the daytime.
At night.
No, wait a minute. When the CO2 goes up at night, don't worry about it. If the daytime CO2 and oxygen are normal, if the CO2 goes up a little at night, that doesn't mean anything. The important thing is if you're symptomatic or not, you know?
Okay.
If there's no question of any symptoms, then I wouldn't put you on nighttime ventilation anyway.
Well, I mean, there are some mild symptoms that may be associated with...
Well, if you may have some mild symptoms of fatigue, for example, so let's say it's just fatigue, then what I would recommend is you try nighttime nasal ventilation, and if you feel better using it, use it. And if you don't worry about it.
Okay, but they tried me on CPAP, and I didn't notice...
CPAP is useless.
Okay, so really I need to be... try it on the BiPAP to see.
Well, you could do that, but I wouldn't even recommend that. I would recommend the volume cycle ventilator with no EPAP.
Okay.
Using assist control. And, you know, if you look at the typical letter of medical necessity on the website, you'll see, I think I have the usual settings that I prescribe on there, too.
My question is on ankylosing spondylosis. I don't know how many people with Pompe's disease has ankylosing spondylosis, but the gentleman I care for has a very severe one, and he has been trached and on a ventilator for 5 years now, and I'm hearing that, you know, trach isn't the way to go, but right. With the spondylosis, do you think there's any chance that I'll be able to get him off the ventilator onto this lip seal that you're talking about?
Yeah, it's not off the ventilator, it's off the trach, and the answer is absolutely. With ankylosing spondylitis, the throat muscles are usually 100% normal. So the only problem is the breathing and the coughing, and the breathing and coughing we take care of. Now, when you've had a trach, the trach can cause so much damage to the airway that it may be impossible to get rid of the trach. So it's always better not to get one in the first place. But most people with trach tubes, the trach tubes can come out. See, 20 to 70% of people with trach tubes develop tracheal stenosis. And if the stenosis is bad enough, you can't remove the trach tube. So it's just a question of how much, it's just a question of how much damage has been caused by the trach tube before. You know, we evaluate, the way we evaluate people to take out trach tubes is we put a fenestrated tube in and cap the tube and then inflate the lungs with air, press on the belly, and we measure that flow. If that flow is 160 liters per minute or more, then the airway is sufficiently clear. In other words, the stenosis isn't so bad, and we can take the trach tubes out. Whether the patient can breathe or not, we'll still take the trach tube out. But if the flow is not that high, then there's got to be some obstruction. And it may not be, you still may be able to breathe through it, through the obstruction, but if you get a cold, the obstruction will not permit sufficient cough flows so that we would not take the trach out under those circumstances. So that's how we basically evaluate people for trach removal.
And but where would the stenosis be, above or below?
No, below the trach tube.
Below the trach tube.
Yes, but you can also have obstruction above the trach tube because, although it's not for you guys, but sometimes when you don't use your vocal cords, they get contracted, and you can have obstruction both above and below the trach tube.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, thank you for your help. I have some great ideas here with my patient here. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Any other questions?
Yes. Would it be possible for a person who has had a trach 13 years because of CO2 levels of 149?
Wait a minute. A trach tube due to what?
I was traked 13 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Because my CO2 levels, my body had accepted the higher levels up till
right.
It got up to 149. Now, is it possible to still come off of a trach tube after that length?
Is it possible to, say that again, please?
Come off the trach tube after 13
yes,
years.
Yes, absolutely. See,
Stacy, there's hope for you, honey.
You see, you can actually have tremendous damage to the airway in a matter of months, or you can have a trach tube for 20 years and be okay. So it's very variable. It's very variable.
What are the possibilities of the CO2 levels going back up into the hundreds?
No. Zero. Because You don't need the trach tube, but you still need the ventilator.
Mm-hmm.
And if you right now you're not speaking long sentences, so that implies to me that you're not hooked up to the ventilator right now. Is that true?
I'm on the ventilator.
You're on it now?
Yes, I am.
So you're waiting for the ventilator to cycle to speak?
Not always. It just happens sometimes.
I see. Well, did you ever try a one-way valve so that you could speak continuously?
You're talking about a pacemaker valve?
Yeah, well, or you can simply put a cap on the expiratory valve of the ventilator circuit. Those caps are free, or they're 29 cents, you know. You don't even have to get a pacemaker valve. But if you do that, you probably could speak continuously, you know. But your speech is not that loud, so it makes me think that you're not getting a deep volume of air. And the volumes need to be deep enough so that your carbon dioxide go back down to normal. It sounds to me like you're not even getting enough air hooked up to the vent through the trach. You should be getting deeper volumes.
Okay.
And you can do that either through the trach or non-invasively. Since your cuff is deflated, the volume on your ventilator should be at least 800 milliliters. And many of our patients use 1,000 to 1,500 milliliters either through a mouthpiece or through a trach tube. So if your volume on your ventilator is less than 800 milliliters, not only does that cause you not to speak loudly and long, but it also doesn't correct your carbon dioxide.
I'm at 600.
Yeah, see, 600 is not enough for somebody with a deflated cuff or with no cuff. Because 600 is what you need to go into your lungs, but you're using half of that to speak with. So your carbon dioxide has got to be high.
Okay, but doctor, what about the size of your body?
Doesn't matter. I mean, sure, it does matter.
Petite people. I know Stacy's small and so
no,
am
no,
I.
No. Still, okay. She's not getting enough air. I can tell from the way she's speaking.
Yeah. What about scoliosis?
What about scoliosis?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that makes you need the air under higher pressure. But it doesn't matter that much. I mean, still you can use non-invasive ventilation, even with scoliosis.
Okay.
I hate to say it, but there's 5 minutes left.
Oh, Marcia.
I know. It's gone by way too fast.
Hey. Marcia, will you send us out some of this information?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I'm definitely going to his website, that's for sure.
I've been on there already while he was talking, and I found the letters of medical necessity.
Good.
Yeah, easy.
Good.
Doctor, my wife's been on the BiPAP for 14 years, mm-hmm. and she's also been on 3.5 liters of oxygen. Now, this is just at night.
But if the BiPAP settings were appropriate, she wouldn't need any oxygen.
The IPAP is 15 and the EPAP is 0.
No, you can't get an EPAP of 0. There's no BiPAP machine that goes to 0. So it's got to be at least 2 or 4.
Okay, it's down at the minimum.
Okay. Well, then it's a span of about 11. But see, the question is, what is her CO2 and her oxygen saturation during sleep? If she's not symptomatic, then she's adequate, okay? But, you know, often doctors give oxygen even when the oxygen in the body is normal. They just do it out of routine. We call it vitamin O. You know, if it's a waste, then it's a waste, you know? Mm-hmm. And if her carbon dioxide is still elevated despite the BiPAP, then she needs a higher BiPAP setting, or she should be switched to a volume machine or switched to a lip seal. But oxygen is not a substitute.
The IPAP can be set as high as 22 in this machine.
Yeah, but there are other machines that go to 35.
Okay.
And with a volume ventilator, it doesn't matter because you can set the volume at any volume that you want.
Mm-hmm.
You see, look, people with a lot of scoliosis, they don't get very much air at the same pressure that people who don't have scoliosis, see? Because the scoliosis makes the lung and chest wall stiffer. So if you set BiPAP at 20, it's going to deliver air until it feels a pressure of 20 and then turn off. Now, if you have a lot of scoliosis, or if somebody's overweight, let's say, then it might only deliver 300 milliliters of air and reach a pressure of 20. Whereas somebody with normally compliant lungs could get 600 or 700 milliliters of air at a pressure of 20. That's why each person has to be sort of evaluated individually, you know. But the bottom line is the carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide should be normal day and, for the most part, at night, too.
Well, that's what's happening to her. Her CO2s just continue to go higher and higher with it.
No, but they're not normal then.
Yeah.
Okay, so therefore, not only does she need better settings at night, but if her sats are going down during the daytime, she needs to get some deep breaths through the mouthpiece during the day, too. But see, first of all, I can't say that she needs help during the day if she's not getting adequate ventilation at night. Because most of the time, if you're on proper settings at night, you don't need anything during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the oxygen is telling her brain she doesn't need deep breaths. So it's causing more air to leak out of her mouth. And so the nasal ventilation isn't working as well as if she wasn't getting oxygen because of the oxygen. It's a terrible mistake to use oxygen as a substitute for ventilation.
That's what they did with me, I'm sure.
By the lip seal, is this the one that goes over the nose and the mouth?
No. No, we call that an oral nasal interface or an anesthesia mask.
Mm-hmm.
Again, look on the website or look in one of the books or one of the articles on mouthpiece ventilation. A lip seal is a plastic flange that seals the lips and the mouthpiece goes through it. And there's straps to hold it around the ears, see?
Mm-hmm.
So there can be no leak out of the mouth, and the only place air could possibly leak is out of the nose. And a couple of patients actually put cotton in their nostrils to prevent that. So then they've got a completely airtight system, and all the air has to go into the lungs. But that's only about 3% of people need the cotton in the nostrils. And those are only people with zero vital capacity, so none of you would need that. But
things like that would eliminate sinus conditions.
Well, right. Nasal ventilation is associated with some sinus problems. Lip seal is not.
Okay, Dr. Bach, I snore horrifically. I recently did an overnight oximetry, and they were beautiful numbers, really well, 98, even at one point 100. I think the worst it got was maybe 94. But I have a nasal, mask.
Wait a minute, you say that you snore.
I do.
And yet, was your sleep study normal?
My recent overnight oximetry was perfect.
Well, no, the oximetry can be perfect, but...
Uh-huh.
But
I don't know what my CO2s were.
Wait a minute, are you using nighttime ventilation?
Yes, I'm on a VPAP.
Uh-huh. Oh, no, you're not snoring. What's happening is the air is going through the nose and going...
Yes.
Like that. That's not snoring.
Oh, that's not snoring?
No, that's normal.
Okay.
No, that's just the air leaking out of the mouth.
Out of the mouth, okay.
Yeah.
Well,
it's important for the air to leak out of the mouth. Otherwise, you could get hyperventilated.
Okay.
Explode.
Oh, then, okay, thank you, because I was worried about that if I was losing vital air and...
No.
But it is embarrassing. I literally wake myself up. I'm so loud.
Well, you could switch to a lip seal, you know.
I might look into that.
Try it. Look, let me tell you something. It's really good to have versatility with non-invasive ventilation.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's say that you get a bad cold and your nose is totally congested.
Oh, yeah.
And you just can't keep it open. Well, the best thing to do is to switch to a lip seal until the cold is over.
Great. Okay.
Now most people do prefer nasal ventilation because it's easier to talk, even though a lot of people are not supposed to be talking when they're asleep.
No.
But still, it's good to have the versatility to know that you can use a lip seal if your nose is congested.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
Okay, so get one. They're
Thank
not expensive. And use it when, you know, you don't need it, so that if you do need it sometime, you can always use it.
Dr. Bach, are you taking consultations if people wanted to come see you to...
Sure. On Wednesdays and Thursdays, I see outpatients. And what you would do is you'd just contact my secretary for an appointment, you know. And her email address... I don't think it's on the website, actually, now that I think about it, but it's Brady, B-R-A-D-Y, K-L, Brady K-L, because her first name is Keisha, and then it's at umdnj.edu. So it's University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, umdnj.edu.
And where is this located, in what city?
Oh, we're in Newark. It's 9 miles from New York City, but in New Jersey.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
What's the machine called to check the inspiratory muscles?
What's that machine called that does what for inspiratory muscles?
To check the inspiratory muscles.
The inspiratory muscles. Well, the spirometer measures all those volumes, the vital capacity, the insufflation capacity, all that stuff. You're asking for a machine to evaluate the inspiratory muscles or to rest them?
To evaluate them.
Well, to evaluate them is basically a spirometer. But, you know, the carbon dioxide monitor does that, too.
Yeah, a capnograph.
Yeah, because if the inspiratory muscles are not strong, the carbon dioxide goes up. So,
Stacey, I think you're thinking about the capnograph.
Mm-hmm.
What about
the ABGs?
Inspiratory muscle trainer, is that?
No, an inspiratory muscle trainer is useless.
Is?
It's really useless. It's never increased the vital capacity of anybody. What's much more important than that is what I explained to you in the beginning, which is lung expansion. It's mobilization. It's air stacking. If your vital capacity is 50% of what it should be, you're only expanding 50% of your lungs, and the other half is closing down, and the chest is getting stiff. You can only take a deep breath to your vital capacity. So incentive spirometry and inspiratory muscle training are not helpful.
Okay. Is the ambu bag for that?
Right. An ambu bag through a mouthpiece, for most people, you can go up to close to 100% of your predicted capacity, and that's what keeps the lungs healthy.
Where do you get those?
An ambu bag you can get from a surgical supply store. They're about $25, $30. Sometimes, though, you need a prescription for that because they're considered medical equipment and people will have no idea what you want one for because they're called manual resuscitators and you don't want them for resuscitation. You want it for air stacking, which they're not going to understand anyway. But they're only about $25 or $30.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I have one question. I have an escalator machine and I was wondering, is that the same thing as air stacking?
Ah, very, very good question. The inexiflator is now called a cough assist.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. Yeah, but that's okay. That's okay. There are two things for using that machine for, okay? There are two reasons for using that machine. One is, as I explained about coughing, if you have a cold and you can't cough strongly, that machine gives you a deep breath through a mask, and then the pressure drops suddenly from plus 40 to minus 40 centimeters of water, and that creates a cough flow that brings secretions out of the airway. And during the negative pressure, if your belly muscles are weak, someone should press on the belly too to combine the Heimlich maneuver with the negative pressure. Now, the second reason for using that machine is if your throat muscles are not strong enough for very effective air stacking. So, if your vital capacity is, say, 50% of what it should be, but your throat cannot hold a deep breath up to 80% or 90%, then you can actually get that 90% by getting one deep breath from the inexiflator or the cough assist machine. So you can set that machine at a pressure of 40 or 50 or 60 centimeters of water and fill your lungs with air that way. So I recommend that people do that when they're not good at air stacking. And of course, with BiPAP machines, unless you have an ambu bag, you can't air stack anyway because you can't air stack with BiPAP. So in third world countries, you know, like South America and Iowa, you know, where people are using BiPAP machines, I tell them to use their cough assist for the deep breaths, for the deep volumes of air, because they can't air stack with the BiPAP. Okay, so you can use that machine both for coughing and also for range of motion for your lungs about three times a day, fully inflate your lungs.
Oh.
Well,
Dr. Buck, are you involved in the Genzyme study going on right now?
No.
Yeah.
Okay, well.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Bach. Yes, thank you, Dr. Bach.
Nobody should die from respiratory complications of this disease. Nobody. And nobody should ever get a trach. You know, you just need to understand that it's a question of helping the inspiratory and expiratory muscles by applying pressures to the body or to the airway. And once you understand that and know how to do it, whenever you get bronchitis or you get sick, you'll be able to prevent your oxygen saturations from going down and getting pneumonia. Okay?
Great.
Thanks, Dr.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Bosch, very much. Thank you, Marsha.
Well.
I put some of that information already on the GSD net. So, as far and as soon as I get transcripts written, we'll get the tape on also.
Okay, I'm going to say goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you so much, Dr. Bosch.
Thank you. Thank you, Marsha.
Thanks, Marsha.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.